Air Force Gannets and Shackletons took off from Broady Naval Air Force Base before dawn to join the naval ships and lifeboats that had searched through the night. A Shackleton pilot spotted the first body about midday, just off the Tusker Rock and about 20 miles north of where it had been thought the plane crashed.
Now, that is coverage of the famous Tusker Rock air disaster, which happened in 1968. And why are we reminding you of this? Well, we're actually reminding you of that because you so rarely hear of air crashes today. How safe are we when we fly? Well, pretty safe. But we're joined by Kevin Byrne, retired Air Corps Lieutenant Colonel and lecturer in aviation safety management at DCU. Kevin, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
How safe? Because we just don't hear. Unless they are malevolent happenings,
yes, yeah.
We don't hear much of routine air crashes.
It's remarkably safe to the state of being unbelievably safe. And I've just been able to get the 2016 figures, which show the downward trend in accidents over the years. There were 75 accidents. We're talking about airplanes here now, which weigh more than 12,500 pounds or 5.7 kilograms. It's just a measurement. They have to be commercial aircraft using a turbine. That's a jet engine or a propeller, you know, jet propeller. And they are on commercial use with people on board. So we've had 75 accidents, but they led to the number of deaths is minuscule, 182 deaths. Now, I know it's not good for those who are, you know, killed in the aircraft, but 1.5 billion
people. We're talking globally now.
Yeah, globally. So more people get killed on the roads in Ireland than can ever be killed in commercial aviation. And this is going down as the trend because now for every million departures, that's a takeoff of an aircraft like that, the accident rate is 2.1 accidents per million, which is the lowest it's ever been in that regard. That includes some of the perhaps potentially high-risk areas like maybe Asia or Pacific or Africa.
Mm. So when you get on your holiday aircraft, it's going to be pretty safe.
Very safe.
It's very, very safe.
The most dangerous part, in fact, is getting to the airport.
In your car? Driving.
Yes, yeah. Or even walking across the ramp, you know, to the aircraft itself is a bit more dangerous than getting on the aircraft. I know that's sort of a small comfort for those. Maybe 10% of the passengers are a little bit afraid of flying. There is a huge industry behind that, you know. And to get over the significance of that, the figures may not, you know, change the mind in that regard.
Now, when you look at the number of miles travelled by road versus the number of miles travelled by air comes out, you know, hugely safe per mile travelled.
Yes, yes.
However, your aircraft journeys tend to be a lot longer than your motor journeys. So you might think that it's skewing the stats a bit.
Well, it isn't, because the amount of safety management systems that have been put in place to make aviation safe is quite staggering. And we're talking about, you know, the people who fly the aircraft. They're trained in a particular way. They're tested, you know, twice a year. They have to have a medical. The people who
fix
the aircraft.
But they still miss people, the guy in the Alps who flew the plane into the Alps.
An anomaly. You know, when you look at that, and I'll talk about this in a minute, the Reason, Professor James Reason has a kind of a system in place, which is a risk management, and you put screens in place to prevent a problem becoming an accident like that. If you slip between the holes of the Swiss cheese, as we call it in aviation, it's also used in other industries, then you can have an incident becoming an accident, which in some cases might be fateful. But as far as I remember the accident report, and I do read them quite regularly, the particular pilot involved in that, and potentially in other accidents, which are not yet classified, they had a mental instability problem that could have been notified to their employers and perhaps should have been because, you know, they are presented with a medical
problem. Whose job is it to tell? He goes to his doc. The doc says, you're mentally unstable. You should tell your employer or take time off. He thinks, I tell my employer I'm a bit mentally unstable. I'll never work again. So he doesn't tell his employer. And then this thing happens. Now, they have put procedures in place.
Indeed, yes.
Now,
after
the event.
Yeah, it was in European Union law which prevented them telling the company, as far as I know. I mean, this could happen to a driver of a tram or a bus or a truck in that regard. The person concerned has given themselves, you know, the potential solution, but their boss says the boss doesn't know about it because they're not in the loop, so to speak.
Now, what they've done in the meantime, I don't know whether doctors are now obliged or encouraged to tell under EU law and data protection and all the rest of it, but they certainly changed the procedures in the cabin in that when a co-pilot leaves, he is replaced by one of the cabin crew.
Yes.
So there's never just one person.
Exactly.
In the
and in fact, of course, people don't remember in the old days, as we used to call it, that's before 9/11, 2001. People would, you know, if I knew them in the cockpit, they'd bring me to the cockpit and strap me in. It was a fantastic place to be. And they'd say, do you want to stay for the landing? And it was grand. We'd have a cup of tea and a chat like that. In other words, people were encouraged to go in and look and see what the pilots are doing in that regard. After 9/11, the doors were armoured. All aircraft doors are now armoured. How armoured they are is a moot point like that. But, yeah,
but
if
but
you're
then
in there,
if you're inside and you're on your own, EO, and you're crazy, you can crash the plane. So you're not allowed to be on your own anymore.
And that's a reasonable, but it's again, it's a safety management system. They said, let's do this to make it safe like that. Getting back even to fundamentally, before the aircraft fly 11 or 12 hours a day, they're tested by technicians who bring them out early in the morning and fuel them and check them. So no aircraft hits the ramp for a service for the day without being checked. After a certain number of flying hours, the manufacturer says we must change this and this and this and check this and this. Mm. And they are done rigorously.
I saw on the tarmac overseas one of the Ryanair guys get out of the plane and then walk around the plane
Absolutely.
And visually inspect it.
Yes, it's
now, why do they do that?
It's another safety element like that. Nobody, from the time you get into the flying club to the time you're flying a big A380, one of the crew will be designated to do a physical check. You're signing for the fuel, you're told by technicians this is perfectly good to go, but you are the aircraft captain or you're one of the crew. You'll take it on yourself to see visually everything is okay. And this has proved dividends before. People have found bits and pieces stuck on aircraft that should have been taken off before flight. You see the tags removed before flight. One of them wasn't. He said, I'm not flying this aircraft without that taken off. So it's a final check, so to speak. And even more than that, there is a checklist system, which I'll talk about in a minute, which is done by the flight crew taxiing out to the aircraft, to the runway. And we check before we go. We check the full and free movements of the controls. So everything is working. We get green lights where we should have them. So the aircraft has it. And I've been in aircraft and it annoys the hell out of me, taxiing out. And I said to the guy beside me, we're not going anywhere. And he says, why? Because we're turning back to the ramp. Something has gone wrong with this brand new aircraft like that. So 2 hours later, we get the bit replaced and away we go. But that is how safety overcomes the carriage of problems.
And the pressure on pilots to get to their slot.
It is high, yeah. Yeah, and I had a personal experience 2 weeks ago when we went to Birmingham, from Birmingham to Dublin. There was an emergency, so we couldn't go. Lost our slot, had to wait another hour and a half. I mean, it's nobody's fault. And, you know,
There is a psychological pressure on a pilot not to miss the slot. So
there is
that little red light that blinked last week and now it's blinking again. And there was nothing wrong last week when it blinked when they checked it.
Yes,
now it's blinking again. Ah, let's go.
That can bring complacency like that. Also, you'll be aware that some of the short haul and quick turnarounds are 25 minutes, which is not a great deal of time. And if you have a problem in any shape or size, you've got to push yourself. Because how often have you heard waiting at an airport? The aircraft will be late in departure because of the late arrival of the incoming, which doesn't help you in any respect like that. European airspace is very crowded. Today, summer's day, there'll be 12,000 flights in different parts of Europe, east and west like that. That is a huge amount of efficiency in that regard. And sometimes the airports are a wee bit crowded, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. It isn't so much the takeoff and landing. Perhaps it's the place to park or the place to move on the taxiway. So all these things that
And we have had accidents on the taxiway.
Yes, one of the features I looked at over the last couple of days is the fact that a lot of the problems, the minor incidents like that, are as a result of crowding on taxiways and stands. Aircraft bump into each other far more on the ground than they ever could in the air.
Now, I remember years ago doing a course in aeronautical engineering when I was supposed to be studying something else, but I was fascinated by it. And one of the things that was said to us at the time, and I can't give you the exact numbers, but they said an engineer building a bridge builds in 100% redundancy.
Yes, yeah.
An aircraft designer might build in 15% redundancy.
It's not quite as simple as that because aircraft...
You know, because if you make it so strong,
that's
it won't take
that's
off.
That's right, yeah. And in fact, look, I was looking at the weight limits on a 787 from which I flew from Hong Kong to Heathrow Airport a couple of weeks ago, and it's 20% lighter than it might be because it's made of carbon fibre. Isn't that fantastic? So you get, you know, less noise, less weight to carry, more efficiency, and that you can carry more of a load, so it's more efficient to run. But that's the way aircraft are designed. But the vast majority of the bigger aircraft and the smaller ones have two engines, so they are, you know, they're redundant in that regard. You can fly these aircraft on one engine. And you can take off if you hit the rotation speed with one engine. It is safe to take off like that. It won't do it very well, but it will do it safely. So in that regard, everything is usually triple redundant. Take the Airbuses now. They're fly-by-wire, which means there's no physical...
No matter how much you pull on the stick...
A computer tells you like that. But there's triple systems in there, not just one or two. There's a third system. And to my knowledge, none of them have ever failed in that regard. People said, oh, this won't work. It's electric. We can't trust this machine like that.
Yeah, because there was a time there was a physical link, a cable running from the stick.
Yeah, physically. And it's pulleys and twists and turns, and you can check and gauge it. But this has proven itself to be lighter, more efficient, and more reliable. So it's triple redundancy on your aircraft system and the Airbuses.
In terms of the design of new aircraft and the testing of new aircraft, first of all, anyone who's ever been in turbulence, if you look out and if you're sitting at a seat near the wing, you could see the wing flapping up and down.
It's designed to do that, to shed the load. I had a personal example of this, of the aforementioned 787. We were held at Hong Kong on the ground because of a huge tropical storm, because of monsoon season. Took off, the last aircraft to do so for 2 hours. Very pleased to be heading to the UK, an hour late. We flew between thunderheads, which I hadn't seen in a long, long time. So there are fantastic pyrotechnics in the clouds left and right of us. I personally loved it. The aircraft was bouncing left and right. It was yawing, pitching and rolling at the same time. People were literally white-knuckled.
Yeah.
I knew it was perfectly safe. I could see the winglet flapping at the end like that. A perfectly good thing to do. We climbed through it in about 5 minutes. We're on top of the clouds and we're on our way to London Airport. And I enjoyed it, but most of the passengers with me didn't for some reason.
Now, the testing of the aircraft then,
yes.
As I say, the wings do flap up and down. They do test them to a remarkable degree.
Yes.
How... If they're, you know, pulling on that wing to see how far up and down it may go before it fractures, how high up will they...
They do that on the ground, and usually it's about 130% more than the braking strain. So they reduce it then. They take these static airframes, bring them into the hangars, basically, and they press them and twist them and pull them up and down like that to the exact same standard.
But they'd actually bring the wing almost to vertical.
They bring the wing until it cracks, and they say, OK, it breaks at 17G or what it might be, so we'll reduce that down to 5, or you must not do this and this, and then they limited like that.
But the wing could deform right up to almost vertical.
Yeah. They're extraordinarily strong things for the weight they have. So they're exceptionally well-designed aircraft.
Some of the techs coming in, what about other countries, particularly developing countries where aviation standards might not be as high? My daughter's going to Southeast Asia and I'm concerned about some of the planes she might be getting on.
I'm glad you asked me that, because I've just been looking at a thing called the EU blacklist. Most people who are not in aviation don't know it exists. And what it is an annual list put out of countries that are banned from flying in the EU. And some of the countries would surprise you. There are some African countries. They follow on, I think, from the Americans who started the system maybe 25, 30 years ago.
And this is to do with they're not happy with the standard of the aircraft, how old they might be?
No, not necessarily. It's the standard, actually, of the maintenance. May I read out some of the countries
sure,
like that? Because I was surprised. Including some of the Iranians, some Indonesian, some Ukrainian, even aircraft that are designed in the States or the European Union. And this is because they can check where these aircraft service with spare parts supplied by the manufacturer, because it's all computer. Nowadays, and they say no, and they list the actual aircraft that are allowed into the European Union. I include countries like Sudan, Liberia, Libya, the Republic of the Congo, Eritrea and Djibouti, which surprise me, Sierra Leone, some Caribbean and Zimbabwe, and a few more. Not a huge list like that. These are banned from flying into the European Union unless the aircraft concerned is coming in to be repaired, which is a good thing.
There was a problem with fake parts.
Yes.
And whether they've combated that effectively, I don't know. Every part should be numbered and designated.
Absolutely. And lifed. It was alleged that the mafiosa involved in certain parts were actually getting parts and cleaning them, basically, and doing nothing more with them like that. If an aircraft part is designed for, say, 10,000 flying hours, as I know some rotor blades were like that, you don't go over that. And this is what's safe about aviation. You take it away.
Now, but that's not to say it'll fracture
next week. Could have. But that's because they've tested the 15,000 hours, so they reduced that. And said, OK, this is good for 10,000 flying hours like that, but get rid of it when it's done. But if somebody is unscrupulous enough to say, hey, let's recondition this, repaint it, renumber it, it's a forgery, it's a fall thing.
This one, I often get nervous when I see how quickly planes turn around in airports. You see passengers disembarking, cleaning staff run through the plane and then new passengers board.
Yes.
Is that safe? Does the plane have enough downtime?
Yes, it does, because there's nothing to do with the start-up and finish. What you have to do is make sure that all the green lights that should be green are green by the time we go again, and now the doors are sealed. And that is good. That is being done properly.
Tell your listeners to check out flightradar24.com. It's fascinating real-time flight movement at all airports on the planet, and it's very good.
It is very good. Not entirely accurate, by the way. I was looking at one through binoculars, and my in-law said, that's a 777. I said, that's funny, it's got four engines through the binoculars here. It's a 747. They've obviously replaced the flight number with a new aircraft type, so don't believe everything you read.
Now, going back to the Tusker Rock and other disasters that we have had in this jurisdiction,
yes.
Or flights... by and large, we've been pretty safe too. That was almost anomalous.
It is. It always was. Do you know that there are about 1,300 registered aircraft in Ireland, of which the vast majority are in fact commercial aircraft, because we have a lot of leased aircraft from Ireland like that. We've got nearly 10,000 flight crew licences, 380 air traffic controllers and so forth. So we're very high up there in terms of numbers for the population we have. But we've had very, very few accidents. We had the Manx 2 crash in Cork some years ago with the Spanish registered aircraft. But This is down to the fact that we have a state safety plan run by the Irish Aviation Authority, and that's very comprehensive, and that tends to look forward and see what are the trends. They analyse all the information, they collated with people in Europe like that, and then they put a safety plan together which will keep tabs on those things that are problematic for them. After all, Ryanair, for example, with nearly 400 Boeing 737s, is the biggest airline in Europe, or will be shortly.
Yeah. In terms of that Tusker Rock crash, there were all sorts of stories that there was a drone out there as a missile target practice.
Yeah, unlikely on a Sunday, though, because the nearest airport is, you know, 80 miles away, and they didn't do Sunday flying allegedly like that. I'm inclined to think, and, you know, it's worth researching again, that there was a mechanical problem with that aircraft, that the control loss took place over a length of time, because allegedly three aircraft of the same type had problems in that regard some years beforehand like that. But then again, we didn't examine aircraft crashes the way we do now. It's remarkably thorough and scientific, and I have every faith in our own AIU unit in Ireland.
Now, two incidents a month in Ireland. Now, what sort of incidents would they be?
They're minor enough, in fact.
Like what?
Well, you might get close to another aircraft, or your TCAS might be alerted. And these are radar devices that tell you an aircraft nearby. But it could be perfectly normal that the aircraft is just passing through your area. The scientific equipment on board is so sensitive now that if we get close to the edge, it might alert both aircraft, in which case we have to do an MOR. That's a mandatory occurrence report like that, but it's dismissed straight away. Or air traffic clearance might give us, you know, clearance and tell us we're 3 miles, and the TCAS will alert. Or it could be something like that. The microwave has gone a bit smoky in one of the aircraft, so they have to put that down as a report like that, even though there's no chance of a fire. So if I get, for example, two headache tablets on a commercial aircraft, that's recorded as a medical event. Do you know that? So it's great. Yeah, I didn't know that myself until recently, but these things are examined and then they're categorised by the IAA and they're sent on for examination if they're serious.
A question from John. Just how important is your seatbelt on a flight? I fly a lot for work, and when I go to sleep on long haul, I like to unstrap myself to get more comfortable, but I always have the air hostess waking me up to say, strap yourself in.
It is actually, I dismissed this myself until I went flying in the aerobatic aircraft, where you get a full 5-place harness and you really are held in. I thought these were more or less useless, like you're going to be thrown off in the aircraft. Not true. Look at the accident video available for the Air Asiana crash in, I think, 2014 in San Francisco. The aircraft hits the tail, a 777, off the seawall, and it catapults to the sky. But only two people were thrown out of the aircraft, and they weren't wearing seatbelts. The rest of the people have been subject to a fair amount of G-forces rotating the aircraft around. Comes to a halt, people are walking down the actual slides taking videos, who obviously have been held in place by the lap strap. So it is quite important in that regard.
I remember being on a British Airways flight one time, and there was a guy who would not sit down as we approached to land. And the steward raced down and roared at him. And he explained that if the guy was standing at the time of touchdown, when the aircraft slows down from what?
120 knots or something like that.
Yeah,
maybe.
Down to perhaps 60.
Yeah.
In the blink of an eye, that this guy would have been thrown forward, because he wasn't braking.
Exactly.
He would be thrown forward. He would be a missile travelling at 60 miles an hour.
That's a fact like that. And that's what happens if the thing detaches. So it's very important to wear the seatbelt, more than I thought initially.
But in the meantime, for those with fear of flying, fear not.
Fear not, it's very safe.
It's very safe. Kevin Byrne, retired Air Corps Lieutenant Colonel and lecturer in aviation safety management at DCU. Thank you very much.